Hello and welcome to Fantastic Fights, the podcast about a middle-aged man reading old adventure game books out loud on the internet. That middle-aged man is me, Hieronymus J. Doom, and this episode we're playing Book 52 in the Fighting Fantasy series, Night Dragon by Keith Martin, with illustrations and cover art by Tony Huff. Or Tony Howe. I can never remember how that's supposed to be pronounced. It's H-O-U-G-H, so that could be Howe. It could be Huff. I'm going to go with Huff. The cover shows a very, very dark image of a very dark dragon, and honestly, it's pretty awesome. I like a really evil-looking dragon rather than a noble-looking dragon, and this one looks like a complete wrong'un with vicious claws, a serpentine neck, and a head that seems kind of skull-like. There's bluish fire glowing ominously in its half-open mouth, further adding to the idea that this isn't your standard dragon at all. I really like it. Tony Huff previously provided the internal illustrations for Spectral Stalkers, and he's a very solid artist. He brings a real vivaciousness to his work, so looking forward to enjoying that. And I'll actually get a chance to experience the artwork properly because I have a physical copy of this book to work from, something of a rarity for the later entries in the series, which are generally priced far outside my meagre resources. On this occasion, though, I have been sent a copy by listener and patron Al Greer. I am astonishingly grateful for this act of generosity, and it's going to make this episode feel like a real treat for me. PDFs are all very well, but there's no substitute for having a physical object in your actual physical hands. Now, the writer of this book, Keith Martin, needs no introduction at this point. This is his sixth entry in the franchise, and he's been responsible for some series highs, as well as some odd lows along the way. He also wrote The Island of the Undead, which we played on the last regular episode, so he's absolutely a known quantity by this point. I'm expecting a few codes, a very high level of difficulty, about 40 items with mysterious numbers attached to them, and a complex design that feels either epic or interminable, depending on how it lands. I'm pretty confident I'll have fun. There's a basic level of quality that Martin's work doesn't fall beneath, but I am slightly nervous about him doing back-to-back books in the series from an editing point of view. I've already looked and discovered there's a few errors in the text, which is honestly par for the course by this point in the franchise, but it's always exacerbated when a writer likes to do pretty complicated designs. Incidentally, there's no update on my gamebook this episode because, owing to some family commitments later in the month, I'm recording this back-to-back with the bonus episode for September 2024. It's a bit weird to finish an episode and then start the next one the very next day. It's giving me kind of Groundhog Day vibes. But I do try to make sure we get two episodes a month as regular as clockwork, come what may. It also means this was recorded a couple of weeks before it goes out, which is unusual. So if anyone new has signed up to my Patreon over at patreon.com/HJDoom between the bonus episode for September and this episode, you will get your shout out. It'll be on the next episode. A big thank you as always to my patrons. It is my Patreon income that gives me the incentive to ensure that there's two episodes a month, regardless of what else is going on in my life. So my thanks as always to those who support me and keep the wheels turning. Let's take a look at the rules. We have skill, stamina, and luck all present and correct, but of course, that's only the start of the nonsense in this book. We get 12 provisions, which is always music to my ears, but then I remember that Keith Martin tends to treat provisions as a second stamina score, so it's almost a bonus stat at this point. It doesn't end there, of course, because we also have a new stat, honour. This is a morality stat which goes up when you do unselfish things and goes down when you behave like a politician. It starts at zero and it can even go below zero, which is quite scary. But we're not done yet. There's also a nemesis score, which reflects how much attention you are garnering from the forces of evil by your actions. The higher this goes, the harder the bad guys will go in return. It starts at zero, and I think it can only go up, which is a shame, because if there's anyone who is capable of messing up to the level where the forces of darkness start to take pity on them, it's this guy. But there's more. Time is also a factor in this adventure, which fills me with dread, quite honestly. Time systems have a history of not working well in game books, but Martin has previously shown a fairly deft hand with the mechanic in his book Tower of Destruction, so I will reserve judgment for now. I think there is a lot that can go wrong, but if anyone can pull off a decent time mechanic, I think it's Keith Martin. The text also warns us about poison and magic, but I'm going to take those with a pinch of salt because the introductions have something of a history of claiming that things will be in the adventure which never actually materialise. I'll certainly be on the lookout for anything that might help with poison, though. It would be just like Martin to fail to provide any magic items, but absolutely deliver on the threat of poison. We have some equipment. We start with a sword, a shield, some leather armour, a lantern and a backpack. Pretty classic adventuring gear. We get a small amount of money too, which is generated randomly by rolling 2d6 and adding 3. I have generated a character who I have decided to call Sparky Winnebago, because that sounds like a suitably heroic name. Sparky has a skill of 10, which might just be good enough, a stamina of 21, and a luck of 10. They have 10 gold pieces, 12 provisions, and their honour, nemesis, and time scores are all 0. With that out of the way, let's play Night Dragon. Background. Beware Black Sand. The words still ring in your ears. This is a city ruled by evil, full of thugs and rogues. Every new morning brings a slumped body in a back alley, its throat cut from ear to ear. Port Blacksand isn't a place anyone wants to stay for long. Although ironically, I am absolutely delighted to be revisiting Port Blacksand, one of my favourite places in fiction. This has already gone up significantly in my estimation as an opening. You're here because a man you trusted whispered that a great challenge might be found here for you. You live for adventure and great deeds, and your friend's expression told you that this was no trivial summons. Setting aside your dislike of Blacksand, you found yourself sitting in the Hemlock Tavern in Clog Street, until late in the night waiting for a messenger who seemed never to come. It was long after the witching hour, with the tavern about to close for the night, when you are finally shown down to the cellars, where a mysterious robed guest was waiting. You drew your sword when you found that a dark elf awaited you, but the weary way he held up his hand and mumbled he was not here to harm you made you draw back. Now you listen to his strange tale. He speaks as if he does not have much time left for him to deliver it. I come from the far north, from the Dragon Reaches. A great and terrible enemy is growing even more powerful there, and he will come to threaten all Alanzia if he is not overcome. Surely not. Must be a Thursday, because a great and terrible enemy is growing more powerful in Alanzia. My people have tried, but we are few in number, and we could not even defeat the stalkers protecting the monster. The sands of time run low. Only a great hero could hope to overcome the Night Dragon. It is an ancient being more powerful than the old ones. The dragons themselves have said to me that even a mortal dragon could not hope to scratch a single scale on the ancient's hide. An ancient dragon? Even a mortal dragon is a terrifying enemy. How can you possibly hope to overcome one far more powerful than its mortal kin? A human would be destroyed with a single flick of such a monster's claws. The dark elf sees your thoughts reflected in your eyes. Oh, there would be no hope at all, were it not for the buried magic which the dragons know of. They say it could make a warrior powerful far beyond mortal limits if the right person came to take the sword, shield, and armour of heroes of legend and face the Night Dragon. I sought for such a warrior for a long time. Yours was the name I heard mentioned over and over again. Ah, the legend of Sparky Winnebago goes before them. You are disbelieving, astonished by what the Dark Elf says. Suddenly he coughs violently and you see blood staining the handkerchief he holds over his mouth. When he can speak again, there is a terrible urgency in his voice. Listen, human, Dragons themselves have told me that when the creature awakens, his shadow will lengthen over all the land, and his dreams of carnage and slaughter will be a reality. They told me that the Night Dragon was within Death's army in the War of Gods before time came to Titan and brought the mortal races with it. Can you imagine how powerful this horror is becoming as it awakens? Never mind your archmages, necromancers, petty tyrants and despots. If the Night Dragon reawakens, they will be scattered like dust in the wind. As will you and I. There are signs already of his stirring from dreamtime. His stalkers have begun to roam the northern mountains, marauding reptile nightmares that they are. Fortunately, they are still few, and not yet strong as they will be, else I would not be here. I mean, it's incredibly difficult to sell a world-ending threat at this late stage in the Fighting Fantasy series, but honestly, Keith Martin is giving it the old college try. References to the backstory as laid out in Titan, the guide to the Fighting Fantasy world, that's really cool. You notice the heavy scars on the Dark Elf's arm as he gestures to emphasise the point, and your initial suspicion of him begins to evaporate. He continues beseeching your help. I hope this doesn't turn out to be a wrong-un Dark Elf after all, because I really like seeing theoretically evil races where there are actually some shades of grey in the morality. The dragons say they are bound by their own oath to kill Anorax, their god and creator. This oath forbids any mortal dragon to offer force to an ancient one. Should one so much as lift a claw against an ancient, it would be struck down at once by a deadly curse. Thus, they are forced to seek help from others. They are surely not indulging in lies or deceit. In the conclave I saw a dragon of each type. Gold, silver, white, black, green, red. Only extraordinary circumstances could bring together a full conclave. The dragons of law and chaos have no love for each other. For them to meet means that a terrible danger must be at hand, as they say. All I ask is that you travel to meet the conclave of dragons and hear what they have to say. I mean, that sounds awesome. Getting to see a dragon conclave. Absolute adventuring bucket list stuff there. Go north to the port of Rentarn, and there take a room at the Rudderless Galley Tavern. Here. Take this silver key and use it to admit yourself to the room there, which has been readied for you. A messenger will meet you in the tavern, and he will tell you how to find the Dragon Conclave. Look, I even give you 10 gold pieces you will need to pay for the sea voyage there. For a moment, the Dark Elf almost grins, albeit painfully. Although you could save some gold by taking the coast road, of course. Please, I only ask you to travel and to listen. How can you refuse? I mean, how indeed? You take the silver key and the 10 gold pieces. So, I have a silver key and I have now 20 gold in total. The Dark Elf gets up to leave, first telling you that you can sleep safe in this tavern tonight. He looks back at you with eyes dulled by pain, and his hands have a fine tremor you didn't see before. I do not want my people to die. Any more than you wish all humans in this land to be slaughtered. If it has cost me my own life to find you, my people will remember me. He turns on his heel, coughing horribly and limps out of the cellar. You do not have pleasant dreams of this night. So we go to paragraph 1. That is a brilliant opening. Really trying hard to sell the threat of this night dragon, and teasing us with visiting the Conclave of the Dragons. I am thrilled by this opening, and it's only slightly undercut by the fact that with all this epic talk of ancient evils and conclaves of dragons, the very first image that we see is a picture of a street in Port Blacksand. Clearly a very muddy street with various ne'er-do-wells strolling about. There's a washing line with some clothes hanging on it. Someone emptying what I assume to be a chamber pot out of a window. And a couple of urchins right in the front of the frame. One of whom is picking his nose and winking at us. And one of whom is tucking into a rat. And it is the most glorious piece of bathos because it completely brings us back down to ground after all of this highfalutin talk about dragons. I love it. A dark morning sky glowers over Port Blacksand and a chill wind blows from the Sword Coast. You can head for Lobster Wharf to find a ship bound for Rentarn, or leave the city by the Weaver Gate to take the North Coastal Road there. You may prefer to buy some extra equipment first. I think we'll go and try and buy some extra equipment. What adventure game book is complete without a list of items to buy, some of which will turn out to be important, many of which will turn out to be useless? You can buy almost anything from the unscrupulous merchants of Port Blacksand, but your most likely purchases will be one or more of the following. A steel mirror, handy for vampires. A rope. A longbow and arrows, that sounds tempting. A glass bottle. Spiked boots, ice pick, flask of liqueur, a keg of beer, a viewing lens, a carved ivory polar bear. I'm not sure why that's included. Potion of stamina or a potion of luck. The spiked boots will be useful in walking on icy, slippery ground, and the liqueur is invigorating and strengthening. The viewing lens helps you see distant locations more clearly when you look through it and also acts as a magnifying glass. The ivory polar bear just catches your eye. You don't know whether it will be useful or not. A potion of stamina when drunk allows you to regain lost stamina points equal to half your initial score. A potion of luck, if drunk, allows you to do the same for your luck. Potions and liqueurs can be drunk at any time except during combat. When you have decided what to buy, amend your adventure sheet accordingly. You must keep a minimum of 2 gold pieces for the journeys to come. So he said that I needed 10 gold pieces for the trip on the boat, and that's the way I want to go, I think. So I need to be a little bit careful with my cash. I didn't give you the cost of all of these items, but they vary from sort of 1 to 5 gold pieces, most of them being in the 3 to 4 range. So I do want the viewing lens. I do want the spiked boots. I would love an ice pick, but I can't get the viewing lens and the spiked boots. So I will go for viewing lens, spiked boots, a rope and a glass bottle, and that comes to 10 gold pieces. That leaves me with 10 gold. I must test my luck. Luck of 10. I get a 6. I am lucky. Luck now 9. So we will seek a ship. Lobster Wharf boasts the scurviest seamen in all Alandzia. Half of them look as though their only reason for not brawling on the dockside is because they're too drunk to raise their fists. After your queries have extracted some foul oaths and curses from these evil brutes, you find out that the Blackheart is sailing for Rentarn within the hour. The ship's first mate tells you that the passage there will cost you 10 gold pieces. Are you prepared to pay that, and have you got the money? I have. I could try to haggle, or I could go and take the coast road, but, I mean, haggling is fun though, isn't it? I mean, not in real life. I'm far too English to actually be comfortable haggling in real life. I mean, I did successfully haggle once when I was trying to buy a second-hand leather jacket, and I felt so dirty after I'd done it. It was shocking. So yeah, I will try and haggle. If you have a stamina score of 20 or more, the first mate looks you over and decides you're a strong fellow, so you can get passage for a mere 4 gold pieces if you're prepared to work aboard ship, slaving at rope tarring and deck scrubbing. You'll get a bunk to sleep in, but you'll have to provide your own food. If you want to accept this offer you can pay, you must double the number of meals which you are told to consume during the journey aboard ship. If your stamina score is below 20, you have to pay the full fare of 10 gold pieces. I want to hang on to my provisions as much as is possible, so I'm actually just going to pay the full amount. Gold now 0, but nice to have the option and a really thoughtful bit of design that you can kind of part pay your way. I like that. Oh, I've just realised there's a thing I forgot to do, which is, as a veteran adventurer, I can add 2 points to my skill, stamina or luck as I wish. I'm going to do that now. and add 1 point to each of my skill and luck, giving me a skill of 11 and a luck of 11, which means that rather than being 9, my luck is actually now 10. What a professional I really am. Knew there was something I'd forgotten. It's cool, though, that you get to be a veteran adventurer. That's a really nice touch, and sells the idea that you might just be the best adventurer kicking about. During the first day at sea, you need food to keep yourself warm against the freezing chill of the north wind. You must eat a meal. Scarf down a sausage cassoulet? Tasty. Provisions now 11. As dusk begins to fall, there is a commotion on deck as a lookout yells, "Greels! Two of them on the port side!" You soon find out what a greel is when a metre-thick white-furred neck lunges over the port bow and a brutish eel-like head darts towards you. The beast opens its black-lipped mouth to display rows of backwards-pointing teeth as long as daggers. You must fight for your life. The greel has a skill of 9 and a stamina of 13. Pretty tough opponent, but I should be fine. I'm going to roll some dice. I have defeated the greel. It reduced me to 17 stamina. For some reason, we both decided we wanted to roll just lots and lots of fives in that fight. The other monster has killed two of the sailors, but the huge furred sea serpent's corpses are now being dragged aboard and skinned. The fur is largely ruined from sword and dagger thrusts, but the meat can be sold even, though it's as tough as old boots. You leave the sailors to their messy work and get some sleep. Add 2 to your time track. Time track now 2. In the morning, you must eat another meal. Thankfully, I brought a box of shreddies with me, making a perfect breakfast. My provisions are now down to 10. It's foggy today, with a creeping sea mist making navigation difficult, and 1 or 2 ice floes go drifting by as you peer into the gloom. One particular floe, some distance away, catches your eye as the mist thins momentarily. You think you can see a dark shape on the ice, though you can't make out any details. Do you want to ignore it, or would you like the captain to let you go over in a rowing boat and investigate the object? I mean, I imagine it's Frankenstein's monster. Those of you who remember the ending of that novel. Yeah, I think we'll investigate. When in doubt, look into things. I mean, it'll probably cost me more time. But honestly, in a Keith Martin book on a first run through, I cannot be concerning myself with time. The chances of me living long enough for time to become relevant are 0. The captain, to your surprise, agrees readily enough. "Arr, we're slowed down by this damnable mist, so another few minutes won't make any difference. But be sure you're quick about it." He spits another mouthful of rank tobacco juice on the deck. You now know why it needs so much scrubbing. You are lowered over the side and row strongly across to the slow drifting flow. The black shape is a body lying face down, clearly frozen to the surface of the ice. A chill settles along your spine as you look at the black cloaked creature. Do you want to investigate the corpse? No, but also yes. The body is that of a dark-haired young man. He is blue with cold and is wearing a simple black robe with a knotted black cord tied around the waist. There is a distinctive tattoo on his left hand which shows a coiled black serpent with a red glowing eye. Make a note of this tattoo and this paragraph number. Hooray! Everyone take a drink. First time we've had to note down a paragraph number. And if you have an ice pick and wish to chip away the body, you can. But I didn't take the ice pick. What a shame. So, back aboard ship, you are graciously given some hot broiled greel for lunch. It has the taste and texture of boiled boots flavoured with fish oil, but at least it's hot and nutritious. The mist is beginning to lift, and despite the captain's gloom, the ship arrives at its destination just before dusk. You round the coastline of Corpse Bay and arrive in Rentan. Add 2 to your time track. Time track now 4. This is a trading outpost where fur trappers and hunters mix with fishermen, and you have no doubt some Sword Coast pirates. Frost is forming on the wooden roofs of the town's warehouses, taverns and homes even as you look. Dour-faced people are hurrying through the cold to get home to their suppers and burning wood fires. Do you want to buy some extra equipment or food? No. Sell some furs if you have any. I do not. Head straight for the Rudderless Galley Tavern. Yeah, I will do that. The sign of the Rudderless Galley swings, creaking to and fro in the north wind. Approaching the dockside tavern past the alleys and byways, you thought you saw a grey-robed man duck into the shadows just before you reached the tavern door. Was it just a trick of the light? I mean, I'm guessing it wasn't a trick of the light, I'm guessing it was a grey-robed man. You push past the seamen and merchants inside the tavern, walk across the sawdust floor to the stairway and climb as far as the landing. You make your way to the third door along as instructed and take the silver key from your pocket. Test your skill. Skill 11, this should be fine. And it is. I roll a 3. Three grey-robed men are standing in the room and a body lies slumped on the bed. The window to the docks beyond is open. The men have koshes and knives and they've been expecting you. They are all dark-haired and have an evil glint in their eyes. As one of them slams the door shut behind you, you know you're going to be lucky to survive this. You can fight them one at a time in this enclosed space as you back into a corner of the room. There is a picture of the three assassins with cudgels and knives. They look great, swathed in their dark robes and all wearing sinister expressions. Yep, bit of kind of forced perspective on the room. They're looking directly into a corner, which gives us nice perspective lines into the corner of the room, really adds some depth to the piece. It's a lovely bit of work. The first assassin has a skill of 8, a stamina of 7, the second a skill of 8 and a stamina of 8, and the third a skill of 8 and a stamina of 8. This could take a while, but I'm going to roll some dice. I have defeated the assassins. They reduced me to 13 stamina, so I'm going to take the opportunity to eat a meal, one of those massive Toblerones that you get from airports, and return my stamina to 17. My provisions are now 9. If you win, which I have, you turn over the body on the bed. It is that of a dark elf, presumably the person you are expecting to meet. His throat has been crushed, and he is beyond help. Frantically searching his body, you find 3 gold pieces and a silver plaque clutched in one hand with the single word hastily carved into it. Endymion. Outside the door, there's a commotion. Someone is banging on it, asking what is going on. So I now have 3 gold pieces, and I have a choice to make. I can open the door, I can search the bodies of my attackers, or leave through the window. I'll search the bodies of the attackers. Never miss out on a chance to rummage through a dead man's pockets. You take 3 gold pieces from the bodies of the cloaked men, and are just about to take a piece of paper from the inside pocket of one of them, when the door is broken down, and the landlord, accompanied by 2 militiamen, rushes in. You've just been discovered in a room with 4 dead bodies, apparently looting one of them. It doesn't look great, does it? Do you want to give yourself up? Gold now 6. I think I can talk my way out of this. I'm not going to jump out the window. I'm going to try and talk my way out of this. I'm going to gamble that the piece of paper contains the instructions, go to the tavern and do a murder, and that this will, in many ways, absolve me of guilt. The militia are very suspicious indeed, although they clearly know the Grey Road men to be evil people. They cart you off to jail and keep you there for some time. If you didn't try to escape through the window of the tavern room, they hold you for 2 days, add 4 to your time track. So, time track now 8. If you did try to escape, they hold you for 5 days. So, I made the right decision. Then they turf you out. You've only got 1 lead about where to go next. The silver plaque with the word Endymion on it. You are forced to spend valuable time here in Rentarn trying to find out what this clue means. Every day you spend here, you must add 2 to your time track. If you are being hunted by the militia, you must roll 1 die each day. If you roll a 6, something happens. Well, I'm not being hunted by the militia. Also, each day you must pay for food. You must deduct 1 gold piece or 1 unit of provisions each day you are in Rentarn. That makes sense. If at any time you get desperately short of food, you can spend 1 day doing menial labour in the town and earn enough to buy 3 provisions, but you must add 2 to your time track if you do this. Again, makes really good sense. Quite like the idea of the greatest adventurer of our age forced to ride a Just Eat bike around for a day in order to raise funds for saving the world. That sort of really highlights how broken an economic system capitalism really is. So we've got some choices though. Choice of 3, we can look for a place called Endymion. We can ask around for a person named Endymion, or we can try and find out more about the grey-robed men. Now, I happen to know that in mythology, Endymion is a person, although it's not usually spelled quite the same way as this. It's usually spelled with a Y rather than an I. I know Keith Martin was a knowledgeable chap, so I'm going to ask around for a person named Endymion. You spend a wasted day asking around for a person with the name of Endymion, but all the people you question shake their heads and go about their business and you get nowhere. Do you want to spend another day trying the same strategy? So I've got to add 2 to my time track, taking it to 10. Never let it be said that I gave up on a stupid idea. I'm going to carry right on. On a chill, grey day, you trudge around the town asking for Endymion and again getting no helpful response. Late in the afternoon, you see a grey-robed figure disappearing in through the back door of a leather tanner's workshop. Do you want to follow the man? Otherwise, that's the end of the day. You can spend the next one asking for a person named Endymion or for a place with that name. So, I can tell already that if I carry on asking for Endymion, it sends me back to the paragraph I just came from. So I could actually just spend an infinite amount of time going around trying to find someone called Endymion if I was a particularly bloody-minded idiot. But I'm not. I mean, I'm an idiot, but I'm not that bloody-minded. So I'm going to follow this man to the leather tanner's workshop. The door has been left ajar. You overhear snatches of conversation, one man saying to another, "Birthing today. Stop him, and the fool won't know where to go. It must be done." You realise they are referring to a ship that is about to arrive. Do you want to check new arrivals at the docks, go on eavesdropping, or enter the shop? I'm going to continue eavesdropping. "Now we know that the messenger aboard ship is going to be making moves eastwards. He's going to try and find out what the frost giants are up to, and we have to prevent that. We also need to take steps to deal with that idiot they recruited in Blacksand. The High Priest already has stalkers out in the wasteland, and we have an assassin at the docks. He is your money spy. You have served us well." Now, do you want to head straight down to the docks or burst into the room and confront the men inside? So, kind of a bit aggravated that they called me an idiot, but I have to assume that this is someone who's met me. I think I'm going to burst straight into the room. I'm going to try and frustrate their evil plans. You fling open the door and your nose is assaulted by the filthy smell of half-tanned leathers that are soaking in reeking fluids. They do stink, tanneries. They do stink. The robed man stands with a bag of coins in one hand and a dagger in the other, while a nervous, raven-haired young artisan in a leather apron is holding out his hands for the money. At once, the hard-faced sword-wielder spins around to fight you. Talk of money reminds me that I needed to deduct 1 gold for my food yesterday, so my gold is now 5. So, the assassin has a skill of 9 and a stamina of 10. Each attack round, the leather worker will throw a pot full of acid at you while you are fighting the robed man. On a 5 or a 6, it splashes you and you must lose 3 stamina points. If you roll a 1, the acid hits your opponent and he loses 3 stamina points. If you roll any other number, the acid misses you both. So there's a picture of the tannery, with the tanner and the menacing man in his dark robe. Again, really characterful, quite grotesque. There's a hint of the Hogarth about Tony Huff's artwork, which I very much enjoy. But anyway, I'm going to roll some dice. I have defeated the assassin. He did not hit me at all, but I did take a pot of acid to the face, so I was reduced to 14 stamina points. If you win, the leather worker flees before you can catch him, but he leaves the bag with 6 gold pieces in it. Add 1 to your nemesis score. So gold now 11, nemesis score now 1. You head straight for the docks. At last, down at the docks, you have a stroke of good fortune. One of the throng of sailors appears to know something.
Oh, the Endymion, due in from Eelsea at the lunchtime tide. Me brother's second mate on that ship, he says, his chest swelling with family pride.
Sure enough, come noontime, the ship arrives at the dock. You ask the captain if he has any passengers on board. Even as you speak, however, you see out of the corner of your eye a black-cloaked figure skulking below deck. Fearing he may be up to no good, you yell at him and he spins around to face you. A dark elf. He holds up his hands to hush you, and as he does, his head jerks backwards and you see a long, heavy dart protruding from his neck. On the dockside, you spot a black-robed man darting away into a warehouse. Do you want to pursue this assassin, or do you want to try to help the dark elf? Well, I need some information, so I'm going to have to reluctantly allow this assassin to elope. But hopefully this Dark Elf will have some final words to say, which gives me a chance to do the classic Last Dying Breath voice, which I always appreciate. For a second time, your contact has been slain by assassins. The elf manages a few words before the poison on the dart kills him. Excellent. Get ready.
North, northwest, he croaks. Along the Stormdrake Pass. Frost giants have... take them, fire water. Ismat.
And then he is dead. What will you do now? So buy some extra equipment or food. Sell some furs if you have some to sell, or leave Rentarn for the Stormdrake Pass. I'm going to go and buy some extra equipment because I think I need some fire water. So I can buy the following items in Rentarn: steel mirror, longbow and arrows, rope, a glass bottle, spiked boots, ice pick, extra provisions, and a flask of walrus oil for very fancy cooking, or possibly rubbing on waterproofs. I will get the ice pick, which I should have bought last time. Definite mountaineering vibe creeping in. And I will buy the longbow and... or will I? I still need to get some fire water. I think I'm just going to buy that, which reduces my gold to 8. When you've completed your purchases, amend your adventure sheet accordingly. Now will you make for the Rudderless Galley Tavern if you haven't been there before, or leave Rentarn if you've already slept and rested here? I will leave Rentarn, I guess. If you're leaving Rentarn, there's a pass which you must find. If you know the name of the pass, convert it into a number using the following code. Oh, may I please? So it's the Stormdrake Pass. I have solved the code. I'm already irritated. Stormdrake Pass, which grows narrower as the peaks of the dragon reaches margin begins to ascend round it, is not a well-travelled path. The only signs of life you see as you trudge along the rocky tracks are birds wheeling overhead and an occasional lethargic rock lizard skittering away from your footsteps. A few thick-leaved succulents hug the ground tightly, the only plant life you can see. This is barren terrain indeed, but you feel fortunate at having avoided any monsters during your first day's travel, and you sleep safely in a small cave. Add 2 to your time track and you must now eat a meal. So tuck into a few rounds of peanut butter and jam sandwiches, reducing my provisions to 8. And my time track is now on 12. The following day, you come to a fork in the road. North-northwest, the trail is hardly perceptible any longer. Pointing to the northeastern fork is a badly weathered wooden sign, where you can just make out what is left of the original inscription. It says simply to is something er, ismater. You cannot decipher the letters in the middle. Do you want to head northeastwards, or would you rather go north-northwest? So I need to go to Ismater, I think, to get the firewater. Ismater is a large village, nestling in the foothills of the forbidding northern and eastern mountains. Herders, fur trappers, nomadic hillsmen, merchants, and even a handful of barbarian warriors make it a lively place. You need to sleep and rest, add 2 to your time track, and you must then eat a meal. Time now 14. Scarf down a Lancashire hot pot, and my provisions are now 7. Next day you may conduct your business here. You could seek work if you're very low on supplies, you could buy equipment, explore the village fully, or hang around the taverns and inns of the town to see if you overhear anything. Let's see if we can buy some supplies. Specifically, let's see if we can buy some firewater. So, we can buy extra provisions, rope, longbow and arrows, a glass bottle, an ice pick, a flask of walrus oil, or a keg of beer. Other items these simple shops supply are hardly useful to you. Thick furs, evil-looking animal tracks, harpoons and the like. None of those look particularly interesting to me, so I will explore the village. There aren't many sites of interest in Ismater, as you find out during your exhaustive search through the place. Add 1 to your time track. Time track now 15. You do find 2 odd-looking little shops, though. The Firewater Emporium, with a little window stacked full of exotic bottles, and a very dirty and run-down little shop which has a wooden sign with flaking paint on it, which you can just make out the letters EVIL. Oh, an evil shop. Didn't realise places this small even had a Tesco's. Do you want to enter the Firewater Emporium? I do indeed. You ask the eager, squinting gnome about the many potent bottles of dubious spirits you see around the shop.
Best of them all, sir, is Larson's Firewater. 5 gold pieces a bottle, sir, and you'll find no better in all the north, and that's the truth.
Now, this is a steep price, so you haggle with the gnome, who reluctantly agrees to part with this fine spirit for only 4 gold pieces a bottle, as long as you buy at least 2 bottles. You cannot carry more than 4. If you buy only 1, you must pay 5 gold pieces for it. An empty corked bottle will cost you 1 gold piece. So that adds up to 5. That's no help. I guess I will buy a bottle of Larson's Firewater, since I cannot actually afford 2 bottles at the knockdown price. Rather, I can with my 8 gold, but I wouldn't actually have enough to then buy the 1 glass bottle that I need. So, Larson's Firewater. Let's now go and relax in the taverns. Ismater's taverns are much like those anywhere else. Rough, none too clean, with a clientele somewhere between disreputable and repulsive. You sip your ale slowly and eat some good homemade pie, meanwhile listening for any interesting bits of gossip. You don't overhear anything of note, but a grey-robed man sitting in the corner of the tavern seems to be keeping a watchful eye on you. Looking out of the corner of your eye, you see he is lean and dark-haired and has a scar on his face and a tattoo on one of his forearms. So we can go and challenge the robed man, we can go and talk to the robed man, we can leave, or we can buy some supplies. Let's go and talk to him. Who are you looking at? You inquire as you sit down beside the robed man, apparently trying to start a fight. Staring deep into his eyes. Is your nemesis score 4 or higher? It is below that. Pardon me, I must have made a mistake, the man says smoothly. I did not mean to attract unwanted attention. Allow me to leave you in peace. He gets up to go. Do you want to attack him, or do you want to follow him, or do something else? We will follow him. The man slips into the back alleys of Ismater with ease and surprising speed, and you soon lose track of him. Deduct 1 point from your luck. Luck now 9. So all we can do now is leave Ismita and go elsewhere, but we do at least have the fire water we need. Add 2 to your time track for the time spent in the village. Time is now 17. If you have not yet been to the Dragon Conclave, you must do so now. March off east, northeastwards. Okay, I will. Travelling along this broken trail is tricky. Test your skill. If you are successful, you negotiate it safely. I roll snake eyes. I negotiate it safely. Had I failed, it would have just been a twisted ankle and a 2 stamina loss. Add 2 to your time track. Time track now 19. You must now eat a meal. Scoff some chana dal and get on with my day. Provisions now 6. It is mid-afternoon when you see a large winged creature in the sky. Certainly no bird. Your hope that it may be a dragon is rewarded. But what a surprise you get. This is a green dragon, normally a dweller in forests or jungles, not in the cold wastes of the northern lands. The beast lands close by and simply nods his massive head towards you. There is a picture of the dragon. Tony Huff seems to like drawing dragons with really, really long necks, and this is no exception. It is sort of slightly breaking out of the frame to sort of emphasise its size, and there's a unnecessary symmetrical path that it's sort of landing on with some stunted and warped trees on it. It's pretty good. It's not his best, but it's pretty good. You clamber onto the dragon's back and hold on for dear life as he rises into the sky and flaps imperiously to a distant peak, where he lands and deposits you beside a huge cave mouth. Stepping off your enormous mount, you see that the tunnel opens into a vast crater in the mountain, probably half a kilometre wide. Within the crater, awaiting your descent down a seemingly endless set of chiselled stone steps, is a circle of 6 huge adult dragons. Black, white, red, green, gold, and silver. You are one of a mere handful of people alive on Titan ever to have been invited to such a conclave. So, thrilling, thrilling stuff. The dragons are silent as you clamber down the steps and stand before them with your head bowed. The gold dragon speaks, his voice booming in this vast auditorium. It is not often that elder dragons meet in this way, human. We only meet when a great danger threatens us all. We have to turn to a human for help against the waking menace we all face. You have been chosen. The gold dragon pushes his huge 3-meter head in your direction. His eyes are red and rheumy with age, but they shine with expectation and vigour, despite his untold years. The silver dragon speaks next.
Our messenger told you of the night dragon.
You nod slowly.
Then all you need to know is the reason we have asked you to come before us. The ancient was overcome before by human heroes. They had powerful magic with which to defeat him. We know where that magic may be found. There is a great sword hidden in the desolate mist crypt southwest of here. The entrance to them lies beneath a tall mountain with a streak of fool's gold near its peak. To the northwest lies magic armour crafted by the great dwarven artisans of their age and lost when their clan disappeared from Titan. Slate Peak was their old fortress home. Far to the east and south can be found a magic shield lost among the Jubles. The frost giants, a much tougher race than most of their kind. All these artifacts have great power against the ancient. An exceptional hero, armed and protected with these, could vanquish him should he be encountered before his sleep is wholly ended. You may even prevail without all these things, though without at least 2, you would find it impossible to overcome the night dragon.
There is one obvious question left. Where is the ancient? The black dragon grins in a way you do not find entirely wholesome. He has a hungry look about him.
The ancient lies to the north of here, but we do not know where.
The Lore Master knows how to find the Ancient's Cave. We know that if you find the sword, shield and armour, you'll find him. We also know that he has a wandering servant of strange aspect who travels in the Icefinger Mountains. By great good fortune, you might encounter him. Though from what little we know, he will not be what you expect. The dragons give further information. The stalkers which serve the Ancient are reptiles, mutated dragon hatchlings stolen and distorted by magic. The dragons look angry when they speak of these creatures, and they warn you that the stalkers grow more numerous as time passes. There are also robed men, acolytes, and assassins who serve the Ancient, and they hold sway over the town of Karnex. Beware that place. All this takes time to learn, so add one to your time track. The Conclave has now told you the essence of your task, to find sword, shield and armour, and the Loremaster too. It is time to meet your destiny. So, with my time track at 20, I think that is a very sensible place for me to pause the recording. I'm quite impressed that I made it through alive. That's exciting. So, technically, the win on the first playthrough is still on the table. That's very exciting. I'm having a nice time with it. It's quite wordy. It's genuinely a thicker book than the average fighting fantasy novel, but it's using those additional words well to really raise the stakes. The Dragon Conclave is a lengthy sequence where you don't get to make any choices, but I think that's the right choice for something so momentous. So I'm not particularly complaining about that. I've made a note of the Dragon Conclave passages as well, because I suspect I will need to refer back to some of those clues that were presented to me. I'm going to go away. I'm going to play Night Dragon on my own time. I'll be back for you with a few closing remarks in just a couple of seconds. Tatty bye. I am very sad to report that once again the attempt on the book in my recorded playthrough ended in tragedy. Shed a tear for Sparky Winnebago taken from us all too soon. As is now tradition, they perished shortly after I stopped the recording. Following the Dragon Conclave, I set off merrily to rob some tombs in the hope of finding the magic sword I was after, but alas, it turned out that an undead chieftain had something to say about that, and what he had to say was, "Die, intruder, die." It was a proper nail-biting fight where I reduced the wretched creature to 1 stamina and burned 4 points of luck, but it wasn't enough, and I eventually succumbed to a 2-handed sword to the face. I also managed to finish with a negative honour score, which indicates that I died in disgrace. So not my finest hour. Since then, I've delved into the secrets of Night Dragon, and having absorbed and cogitated upon its inner workings, I can exclusively reveal that it is definitely a Keith Martin book. In some ways, that means you can cut and paste the comments from Island of the Undead, as most of them are equally applicable here. For those who may have forgotten, I'll reiterate the headlines briefly. Firstly, there's his traditional plethora of hidden sections. Not only will you be finding endless items with numbers painted on them, you'll be adding up numbers, multiplying numbers, and otherwise doing basic arithmetic to reveal various secret paragraphs. One of them doesn't work. Obviously one of them doesn't work, but honestly, when there's this many, only one of them being wrong is actually something of a win. It's as irritating as it always has been, but thankfully the design of the book makes finding the items a little bit easier, and it's also usually the case that not having an item will make things harder, but not impossible. There are a lot of items, and many of them are helpful, only a few of them are required. This is actually some of the best itemization I've seen in Martin's books. There's lots of options, but there's a lovely balance between the magical and the mundane. Sure, you'll find a magical sphere of light, some seeds that grow instantly into big plants when planted, the odd magical mirror, but there's also plenty of things like ropes, ice picks and crossbows, and they all get an equal chance to shine. I spoke in the Island of the Undead episode about how unusual but ordinary items can sometimes seem out of place and exist merely to solve a problem later in the adventure.
What Martin has done here is very clever because many of the ordinary items exist in multiple locations. The various settlements you go to often have shops, and those shops all have broadly the same list of useful things in them, and that's actually extremely clever. He's made a list of things that might be for sale in a coastal region noted for cold and mountainous terrain, and made sure they're well represented in the text. Having the same list of things turn up twice is actually a subtle bit of world building, because it makes you aware that these settlements are all part of the same region and all share a similar culture. The itemization works even better because, unlike Island of the Undead, there's less of a requirement to do things in a specific order. I quite enjoyed that aspect of Island of the Undead because I like seeing a puzzle box design gradually open up, but it didn't half make that book feel long, even longer than it in fact was. Here you have just a bit more freedom. Once you get past the Dragon Conclave, there's essentially five locations to explore before making your final assault on the Night Dragon's lair. There's three mini dungeons, each containing one of the treasures you will need to slay the dragon, a Dreamtime section which will provide valuable clues, and the chance to visit the town of Karnex that is completely under the thrall of the forces of evil. Although there's arguably a best order to do the five sections in, there's items in each of them that will help in other areas, and they combine in fascinating ways. The best example of this is the town of Karnex. It's really dangerous. Not at all a place you want to be hanging out, but there's also one really helpful book in it that will aid you at three different points in the adventure. The problem you're presented with is that it's so dangerous that going for it early will likely kill you. There's a real tension in deciding whether to do Karnex early or late, or simply skip it altogether. There are alternative routes through the various areas that the Book of Karnex will help you with as well, and actually avoiding it completely might be the best option, depending on the choices you've made elsewhere. There's much more of a genuine sense of freedom in this game than in Island of the Undead, which has an open design but then requires you to take a very specific route through it. I managed to beat the book in the end, taking the various areas in a bit of a random order, and it's delightful to be reading a Keith Martin book where that's possible. It wasn't ideal, and I did have to fudge a few dice rolls along the way, but honestly, this book feels considerably more welcoming than some of his other works in terms of how you approach it. You'll still be seeing almost everything on a successful playthrough, but the different areas having different routes through them, depending on the order you've done them in, makes replaying this book feel less of a chore than Island of the Undead did at times. Also, I think the areas themselves are strong. It's a crying shame we don't get to see more of Port Blacksand in the opening, but it was still nice to visit, albeit briefly. The urban areas are very well designed, and I very much enjoyed seeing all the acolytes and assassins doing their scurrilous work in the background. It creates the impression that the Night Dragon's evil tendrils are spreading even before he is fully awake. You get to see that on steroids in Karnex, which is a fabulous set piece. And the other four mini dungeons are all nicely differentiated from each other. There's a crypt full of undead, a more rural area with the giants, the surreal landscape of the Dreamtime, and an abandoned dwarven stronghold, which is probably my favourite. It's got a Moria feel to it, and that was my favourite bit of The Lord of the Rings, complete with a deadly monster in the depths, but it also has its own identity as well, which is nice to see. It has a maze, and like being lost in the forest in Island of the Undead, Martin chooses to portray it with a dice mechanic rather than with endless identical choices. This is something I cannot support strongly enough, because it gives you the feel of a maze without the growing sense of frustration and rage that most mazes create. Essentially, it's a D6 table with a 6 indicating that you've found what you're looking for, a 2 to 5 indicating that you've stumbled round in the dark to no particular effect, and a 1 indicating that something has gone wrong. A really clever touch, and what elevates this, is that you can spend luck to increase your roll, which adds a little resource management into the equation. This is a really smart choice, because if you roll a 1 for the first time, you find yourself struggling to decide whether to spend that precious point of luck, or let the 1 stand and find out what terrible consequences there might be. It's just great. You could make an argument for the Dreamtime feeling a little bit out of place, but it allows Martin to throw in some more surreal encounters, and that adds to the variety of the book, although it does slightly undercut the also quite surreal finale. The Dreamtime sees a reappearance of the Mirror Demon first seen in Deathtrap Dungeon, complete with an illustration riffing on that first iconic presentation. It's always nice to see a few monsters we've seen before, especially from the weirder end of the bestiary, and it's a nice Easter egg for long-time fans. And the Mirror Demon, with its messed up four-faced head trying to drag you into its magic mirror, is such a strong image that I can see why people have gone back to it. This is probably an appropriate point to say that the art in this is really good. It's full of character, it's nicely detailed, it has a sort of Hogarthian caricature element to it, but it doesn't feel like children's illustrations. It feels like proper fantasy art. Tony Huff has done a really, really good job with the art on this book. There's some stuff that looks just absolutely amazing in here. There's a stench ghoul that I particularly like, and a horrible crab-like monster, of which more later, that looks superb. Not quite Russ Nicholson levels of grotesquerie, but still very much in the upper echelon of fighting fantasy artwork. All of the areas are fairly manageable to explore. Martin layers on complexity with one hand, but balances that by being fairly generous about allowing players to backtrack and make different choices. If anything, I think he might be too generous in this regard. I like finding that there's parts of the book I need to go back to explore on subsequent playthroughs, and there are a few bits that you can miss here, mostly when different items unlock different routes through, but you're not going to end up finding much on a second run if you got fairly deep on the first attempt. What it doesn't have, which I loved about Island of the Undead, is that feeling of gradually uncovering the backstory of the area. There's still some environmental storytelling, but it is a bit more rudimentary as a consequence of having a more expansive story in both time and space terms. I think I just really like rooting around a relatively tight area and gradually finding out more about how it came to be like that. I'm a big Dark Souls fan, sue me. It's probably why I liked the Dwarf Hold best of all the mini dungeons in this game. It's got a combination of a space that makes sense with a backstory that's revealed as you explore. The finale in the Night Dragon's Lair is also strong, arguably one of the stronger final dungeons in the run. It's got a big H.R. Giger influence, which comes through well in the artwork. There's all kinds of weird machines and magical contraptions for you to interfere with before you make it to the dragon itself, which is hands down the most epic confrontation in the whole run of books so far. With a base skill of 17 and 32 stamina, the Night Dragon is an appropriately terrifying set of stats, even before you factor in the time it took to get there, which has the effect of boosting its stamina still further. There's a few little twists in the final approach to fighting the dragon, but ultimately this is a great example of just using the core mechanics to sell the level of challenge. And Martin wisely doesn't do much to take away from the simple but undeniable intimidation of that beefy, beefy stat line. Thankfully, there's ways to mess with the dragon's stats to make it less of a threat, and given that you need high starting stats just to get there, and the fact that you'll be fully kitted out with magical gear, you can actually boost your own skill to beyond that of the Night Dragon for the final fight, which feels awesome. It feels so good. Of course, once the Night Dragon is dead, you'll have to fight it again, this time as a messed up, severed head held up by scary crab legs, as referenced earlier, and that's a suitably grotesque final fight, with a hint of bathos to it as well, as this world-devouring evil gets reduced to a horrible, mutated, skittering crab head. This fight is easier, but Keith Martin really does love throwing in a second fight after the main one. I'm not objecting, this is one of the best finales in the run of books, and it feels much cleaner in design than the previous book without sacrificing impact. You can also cheat your way past it if you're just sick of rolling dice at that point, which I definitely appreciate. It's another example of his use of items being stronger in this book than in previous books. There's lots of things which help rather than serving as roadblocks, and that's true of the finale as well. It's nice to see items that aren't just keys to open doors that are otherwise impenetrably locked. There's usually a way through without the items, but the chances are you'll be faced with a tricky fight if you don't have the right gear. And yeah, that's the design I really like. This is also carried over into the way he uses skill checks. There's quite a lot in this book, but the consequences are fairly mild, which I think is the right approach. A skill check can sell you on the physical danger of the world really nicely. Having to roll to climb down or up things or jump over things is a great way of providing interaction to elements of the story that would otherwise just be the book telling you what happened. But I think as a downside, a few stamina points is better than an instant death in most cases. I think it can be tempting to try and ramp up the effects for a bigger impact, but actually stamina loss works best when it's constantly dribbling away, because that naturally builds tension as the adventure continues, and as you get later into the adventure your resources start to run low, and that's where two stamina here or there really starts to feel like it's making an impact. It's not just the final fight that's good as well. As is common with Martin, many of the fights have special rules associated with them, whether that's the classic ghoul paralysing attack that we've seen many times but is still great, or something more unusual. There's a fight I absolutely love, where you have to make a choice between fighting two enemies at once or fighting them one at a time, and allowing the second monster to sound the alarm and thus raise your nemesis score. That kind of mechanical tension and interaction between different mechanics, that is rare in game books, and it's really advanced design. There's a lot of hard fights, because of course there are, but going into this you probably knew you needed a good character and cheated on the initial dice rolls, so I don't have a massive problem with that. Not to mention that you do get that little plus one or plus two to add to your skill to make things a little bit easier at the outset. And I think all of this illustrates that the biggest strength and weakness of the book is kind of the same thing. It's the most mechanically complex game book I think Fighting Fantasy has done so far. You've got lots of items and clues. Many of them can be used at several different points or in different ways. You've got very complex fights, and you've got several additional systems on top of all that. There is a lot going on. And even before we look at how successful the various systems are separately, there's an effect from having just so much stuff constantly happening on a mechanical level. I found that I was constantly having to look away from the text to write things down, to make rolls, to check my notes, or to make calculations. It's amazing from a formal design perspective, but it has a detrimental effect on the storytelling when you're spending as much time on your character sheet as you are reading the actual text. It does disrupt the flow of the book when there's this much mechanical stuff going on, and it kind of feels at times like I'm playing more of a board game than reading a game book. As a hybrid medium that incorporates game design, visual art, and prose, I think you can end up with some problems if you make one of those elements dominate, and here the mechanics definitely dominate. It's probably a matter of taste more than anything else, but when I think of something like Forest of Doom or Dave Morris's Heart of Ice, at least part of what made those books really stick in my mind was the feeling that I was experiencing a vivid world and an exciting story, and I don't get that so much from Night Dragon, even though it's quite expansively and quite well written. Taken as a whole, the story is fine, especially in the early sections where you've got all that stuff with the acolytes and assassins in the background. I also just don't think you need this many systems from a mechanical point of view, even though all of them function more or less as intended. Let's look at the time system first. This is meant to add a sense of pressure and add a cost to certain activities. In the abstract, this works quite well. Adding to the time track concentrates the mind on the passage of time nicely. At the end, it turns out, though, that time is kind of pointless, serving only to add a bit of stamina to the dragon. It's actually best to completely ignore time and focus on making sure you have enough food to eat, meaning that at one point the best thing for the hero of this dangerous quest to do is to take a job waiting tables or packing orders in a warehouse for a week to make sure that they've got enough food and cash for everything they need to purchase. It's like someone backpacking around Europe and doing cash-in-hand work for beer money more than an adventurer on a desperate race to save the world. That's absurd enough to be funny to me from a design perspective, but it doesn't make a great deal of sense. Time is still providing some value on early playthroughs though, so it's not a dead loss. But I would argue that the way provisions are being deployed as a constantly depleting resource actually does the same thing that time's doing, so it doesn't need to be there. Also, constantly adding to your time track is one of the main offenders in terms of spending more time on the character sheet than reading the text. I think I'd lose it and try to implement time in other ways, either through just the provisions or through forcing the player to only do a couple of activities in an area before then having to move on to the next area. Honor and Nemesis are kind of similar. Honor probably just doesn't do enough to justify its presence. You can get a similar effect by penalising poor decisions with luck penalties and rewarding good decisions with luck points. Nemesis, of the various additional stats, is the best, and if you'd got rid of honour and time, I think you could have focused on making this mechanic really sing. Again, quite a bit of what time does for the text could have been folded into the Nemesis system, because it is, by its very nature, that escalating threat that reflects the passage of time. That would have made a cleaner design, and Nemesis is also the one that just feels thematically appealing as well. You have this wonderful thing where murdering cultists and assassins feels cool, because who doesn't love murdering cultists and assassins? And then if you add a mechanical cost to that tremendously enjoyable murder, it creates exactly the sort of tension that the time mechanic's trying to provide. So, again, I said it a million times, when in doubt, choose one mechanic and explore it thoroughly. One mechanic that is missing from this book is logic puzzles and riddles. There are a couple of places where it feels like puzzles were supposed to go, but they're all handled with items rather than by presenting the player with a message written in baffling code. So there's a book, and if you've got it, you can solve the riddle. If you haven't got it, you can't. And this suits me fine, honestly. It's the sort of thing where you either want to make it a big feature of your book or completely ignore it, and in a traditional fantasy adventure story, I'd rather it was ignored. So overall, I think Night Dragon is basically great. The slightly lower difficulty and the flexibility are a welcome change of pace from Martin, and this stands up with his best work, despite being arguably overcomplicated. I think this is absolutely as far as you can push the game side of game books without things completely falling apart. And on that level, it's the most accomplished book probably in the whole run. It's amazing that he's been able to cram so much into 400 sections while still preserving the tropes of a recognisable fighting fantasy book and still delivering a book that feels like an epic quest. Often when we've seen the mechanics take precedence, the actual adventure itself can wind up feeling very short. So I really admire how much Keith Martin pushed himself within the constraints of the format. He was never willing to sit on his laurels, and if this book has a more standard plot than some of his other work, he's still found a way to make it stand out and delivers one of the few apocalypses that feels genuinely threatening. Yeah, it's the most apocalyptic that fighting fantasy has been in a while. That will do it for this episode. Join me in a couple of weeks when I'll be playing something different. I'm not sure exactly what yet, but I think I need to find something by a creator we haven't covered so far. I feel I crave some novelty. Find out what this desire for new things costs me, psychically speaking, next time on the podcast. In the meantime, you can contact me by email at hjdoomretrofun@gmail.com. or by following me on Blue Sky at HJ Doom. Thank you very much for listening. Take care, and I'll see you soon.